Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the effervescent voice of goalkeeping, Mr. Richard Lee.
Hello.
How are you, mate?
Oh, very well. How are you?
Yes, good, mate. Good. Gutted to miss last week. You did a sterling show on your own with Mr. Dave Besant.
It was difficult. It was lonely, but thankfully Bez kept me company.
Well, this is us now. We are cementing our partnership moving forward. This will be the duo, the twosome, for the foreseeable future. I feel very much like the Smalling, Rojo, Lindelof, Bailly and Jones to your David De Gea.
Indeed. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, we're going to start this week, mate, with a bit of correspondence because we've had a bunch of emails in and a bunch of tweets that have come in, and we're going to try and get through them week after week on these podcasts. So if you have emailed in, just please do bear with us, a bit of patience, and we will get to your emails. I'm going to start with some tweets that we've had from a Rob James Cook and a Tom Collins, who both have asked us who our 1-2-3 keepers would be in order for England. Quite a big debate this weekend with Tom Heaton playing very, very well. Ben Foster, who's retired, has been brought into the mix. And Jordan Pickford, who's had a sort of, you know, up and down season so far. What's your 1-2-3?
It's a difficult question. There's a lot of goalkeepers I'm going to mention now, and then I'll give you my 1-2-3 at the end. But it changes all the time, game by game. So, of course, realistically, it will be Pickford, of course, because Pickford has done it now for a period of time. And as you often see, once a goalkeeper establishes themselves, it's quite a big decision to then bring someone in as your regular number one. However, at the moment, is he the best goalkeeper or is he the keeper that's most in form? I would say no. It hasn't gone particularly well for Everton on the whole. He's done okay, but certainly not to the standard I would argue that he was at last season. Obviously had a huge summer in the World Cup, and there's been a few moments this season that have gone against him, and the fact that he's playing in a struggling Everton team hasn't done him any favours. In terms of who are the hottest keepers right now, you'd have to say Ben Foster. You'd have to say Tom Heaton. I think Ben Foster, it's incredible. We talk about him way too much on this podcast. I'm very aware of that. His name seems to come up all the time. But he's
not sponsoring the podcast.
No,
I mean, you just do need to confirm that.
No, I should really get some commission or something from him. But he's doing brilliantly. He just seems to be getting better with age. It is a bit of a cliche that goalkeepers get better with age. But the reason for that is that goalkeeping, you don't need an aerobic capacity. It's not like you're going to be running 10 miles or 8 miles, whatever it is the lads run in a 90-minute game. It's about power. It's about decisions. And he's got the kind of physique where he is incredibly powerful. He's agile. He loves playing football. You can see the smile on his face when he plays. He does not get bothered by pressure whatsoever. He's quite unique in his way of thinking. So the more I'm watching him, the previous injuries that he's had, they don't seem to be bothering him whatsoever. He looks as strong as he's ever looked. He's very firm when he goes into training, for instance. There was a funny tweet from Troy Deeney where he spoke about Ben Foster and he says, essentially, he doesn't eat very well. He only trains twice a week, yet he turns up on a Saturday and he's our best player. There's a reason for that. He knows his body. He knows when to turn up, when to train, and what gets the best out of him. And he's thoroughly enjoying what he's doing at the moment. And if you look at his record this season, statistically, he is certainly in the top three goalkeepers in the Premier League. And as an English goalkeeper, I would argue he's the number one at the moment. He is, of course, retired from from England duty. So it's very unlikely, of course. But I would say he is the most informed England goalkeeper at the moment. Tom Heaton is very close. The only reason I'd have Tom as a second to Ben is the fact that Tom hasn't played as many as Ben. Of course, Joe Hart playing the lion's share of the season and Tom Heaton coming in for him. And he has done brilliantly since he's come in. We're seeing the side of Tom Heaton, the shot-stopping of Tom Heaton. Certainly when you play for Burnley, you're not having to play out from the back and you're not having to play a kind of game that an Edison or an Alisson would play or a Lloris. You're not having to play and come for through balls. You are reliant on good decision, good communication and your shot-stopping. And Tom Heaton is the perfect man for that role at the moment. Technically, he's fantastic. Had a really good upbringing at Man United. He's not the biggest of goalkeepers, I would say that, but he's a very good decision maker, a brilliant communicator, something that a lot of people won't necessarily see, but he is a very good communicator. And you've seen the difference with the defence at Burnley having Tom Heaton behind, which is a bit surprising because certainly Joe Hart's not a bad communicator, but it has been improved since Tom Heaton's been there, and some of the saves he's been pulling off have been absolutely outstanding. To mention a few others, Alex McCarthy has been reasonably solid despite the fact that Southampton haven't been going particularly well. We saw the introduction of David Button for a few games at Brighton, and he did well, but certainly not enough games to be considered in this particular poll. Jack Butland at Stoke has been going along okay, but Stoke are struggling, so it never reflects well on a goalkeeper, which is tough because we are effectively playing a different sport. We mention it over and over. So he can only affect Stoke so much, but the fact that he's in a struggling team and conceding goals, he won't be particularly pleased with, but his performances individually have been fine. They've been good. He will be hoping to get back to the Premier League ASAP, hopefully this summer. And if he does that, obviously it won't be with Stoke, it looks like now, but if he does that, then I'm sure he will very much be in the reckoning again. Obviously, Bettinelli, who's been involved in England squad, is just about to have a knee operation, so he won't be involved for some time. So to give you my answer, after all that, I've spoken a lot there, but I would say Foster 1, Heaton 2, Pickford 3.
Okay, so if Gareth Southgate goes to Ben Foster and says, I want you in my next England squad. I know you're retired, but I want you to come out of retirement. Essentially, he's done it once before.
Mm-hmm.
He's been so forthright, Ben, even on this podcast, in fact, and said, you know, it gave me a new lease of life. Retiring from international football, I was able to spend time with my family. He's very hot on the fact that he likes his time away from football. What decision does he make?
I think there's only one decision. I think your country comes calling, you have to say yes. The only thing that will go against Ben, and arguably could go against Tom, although not quite so much, as Tom obviously isn't as old as Ben, but is the fact that Ben is the age he is, which is ridiculous. But where it might go against him is, what would be the point of playing Ben in an individual game? You know, other than obviously winning that game. But we know how Gareth Southgate operates. He's not looking about the next game. He'll be looking for the next major tournament, the Euros, next summer. So the question would then be, if you're going to play Ben, it's with the thought being that he could be the number one in, what we're talking, 16, 17 months' time, which, by the way, I think he could. I don't see Ben having a sharp decline next season. If anything, he's going to be player of the season for Watford this season, undoubtedly. I think he's going to continue this form into next season. Similarly, Heaton, he will help Burnley stay up. I believe that to be true. And I think that he will be just as strong next season. It would be a huge call because Pickford, although it hasn't been his best season, you'd argue that he hasn't done badly enough to lose his place. And we see it so often with goalkeepers. Once you have the shirt, it's normally a sending off, injury or loss of form that costs you the shirt. Now, has he been bad enough to cost him the shirt? I don't think he has, which is why I think he will keep the shirt. And with the other options being Heaton and Foster, who some might argue are a backward step, I don't think he would put either of them in. So I think Pickford will continue. But if we were talking clean slate right now, it would be Foster, Heaton, Pickford.
Well, a great answer to a great debate. Keep those questions coming in. And if you want to have your question answered like Rob and Tom have done so, it is very easy to get in touch with us on Twitter at GK Union. On Instagram, it's at GK Union Official. On Facebook, just search GK Union or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. Okay, this week's guest on the Goalkeepers Union podcast is a man who played more than 800 games in a 25-year career. He racked up 8 seasons as an ever-present with Colchester, Luton and Watford. And he is the answer to a marvellously Merseyside-related quiz question that we will get onto later in the show. Alec Chamberlain, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. Now, I'm going to flip things this week and we're going to start right at the very end. There is a method to my madness, so please bear with me. But 2007, your final professional appearance of your career, Watford at home to Newcastle on the final day of the season. You came on for Ben Foster with 1 minute remaining, kept a clean sheet.
I know, it was a pretty nerve-wracking experience even then because, we'd obviously got relegated, but I was pretty creaky by that point. You know, my body was pretty much packed in. So AD probably did the right thing and the ball wouldn't go out of play actually for 2 or 3 minutes, which is probably a blessing in disguise. So eventually when it did go out, I got on. Obviously, Ben got the ovation he deserved for 2 years that he'd given to Watford on loan. And it was obviously nice to go on and get a great reception, you know, to finish off my career. So all round, it worked out brilliantly, and I never touched the ball, so it was even better.
Having been in the game for so long, is that something for a pro? Do you really soak it up when you came on? Are you looking around the stadium, or is it just another game?
Well, it was a slightly different feel, obviously, but I still had the nerves, you know, that we associate with goalkeeping. I think most people do anyway. The nervous stomach, you know, the pit of the stomach. And you don't want to make a mistake. Obviously, it was 0-0. Had we been 2 or 3 up, it wouldn't have mattered. But being 0-0, you don't want to go out with a horrendous mistake in that last minute. And that's unfortunately kind of my mindset, really. It's like, please don't mess up. And so I don't think I could really enjoy the moment until the game was over. And I think that was probably true for all the games I played. But, you know, that's, again, more my mentality towards playing, and I suppose just wanting to do well. I don't think it was anything other than just trying to do the best for the team and best for yourself. Sort of natural kind of process, I thought, but I appreciate it's not always the best way to go about things now.
Now, the reason I mention it, obviously, because at Vicarage Road at the time, it was a case of out with the old, the experienced, the trusted campaigner, and in with the new, untried, untested, somewhat uncertain new number one, goes by the name of Richard Lee.
Richard was had quite a few games really as well, so he was on the way, sort of thing. He wasn't a complete novice hurdler, so no, it wasn't quite, you know, throwing an 18-year-old into the mix. And you know, it was nice for me because I was involved still anyway with the club, being the goalkeeping coach, and I obviously went on to the staff side with AD Boothroyd, so that was great. It was a nice transition, and it was obviously nice for me as well to carry on working with the lads that I'd been working with anyway.
Something I want to touch on, you just mentioned about your mindset towards goalkeeping, and I know we had a very similar mindset where it was almost a not wanting to make an error. It was the kind of avoidance of failure rather than actually going out to be the best player on the pitch. And obviously someone at that time as well, just, again, we get a lot of young listeners that listen to the show, and I know a lot that suffer with nerves and not quite sure how to approach a game. But I guess it's an example of there not being necessarily a right or wrong, where you'd have someone like a Ben Foster, who was very, very confident in his ability, and he would go out expecting to be the star of the show more often than not. And I think me and you, we were probably the other end of the spectrum, where it was more a case of safety first and not wanting to make that error.
We've all got our own sort of frailties mentally when it comes to preparation for a game. There's always, I think you wouldn't be human if you didn't have any kind of doubts. But obviously you've got to get and find a way of dealing with those doubts. And for me, I sort of, those doubts disappeared as soon as the whistle went for the game. So I could be as nervous as a kitten, really, all the way through, even going out, you know, before the game. But then as soon as the whistle went, I was fine. So I think that shows that it didn't become sort of like a stage fright, as it were. It was more a natural process, and you just had to get used to how to deal with it. It wasn't a particularly enjoyable experience, but I don't think there's anything really wrong in it. If I could have been like Ben is now, I would have preferred that. I'm sure you would, Rich.
Yeah, absolutely.
But unfortunately, I don't know why, but maybe it's because I just came so far from left field, if you will, literally a field, in the farming sort of industry, into professional football, almost sort of falling into football. And I kind of went through my career, certainly the early stages, thinking, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm my luck, sort of thing, you know. And then eventually, I suppose, when you think, well, actually, I've been doing it a few years now, and, you know, nobody's stopped wanting me to play for them, so I must be doing okay. But I still couldn't lose that build-up and that nervous feeling going into the game, sadly.
You were a goalkeeper at a very different time. You know, it's no secret everyone talks about the evolution of goalkeeping now.
Yeah.
And I recall you, I mean, it was when I was first really getting into football, and I recall you and a band of goalkeepers at the time, like Bobby Mims and Bob Boulder and Mike Hooper and John Lukic, to name a few classic names from the past. Obviously, it was very different then. And goalkeepers, I think, were looked up to, but Is it fair to say there's a different kind of admiration now with the likes of Alisson and Edison and Jan Oblak and Ter Stegen and Buffon? Are goalkeepers admired in a slightly different way because the game is more, I don't know, glamorous, I would say?
Yeah, I think so. I think the value of the goalkeeper has, as the stock has risen, shall we say. And certainly, you know, the back pass changed when I was playing. I was at Sunderland at the time, I think it was. Maybe the tail end of Luton. But obviously, we sort of didn't really, or the managers and the coaches didn't really want us to try. And I think it was just a question of dealing with the ball coming back to you, getting it away from the goal, putting it in the safe areas. That was the kind of common sense approach that we had. Now, obviously, the modern way is to try and pass your way and pass through teams. Now, I think they've possibly gone too far in some divisions where I think they've been a bit unrealistic with the expectations of A, the goalkeeper and all the also the outfield players, that you know, whether they're actually capable of doing it and without making regular errors, you know, leading to goals. I think there's got to be a fine balance.
There was actually an example in there was a game yesterday, Stoke took on West Brom, and there was one bit I watched, it just made me think of what you said there about keepers now getting to the point where they're almost overplaying. There was a throw-in back to Sam Johnson. He was under pressure and he had no choice but to put it out for a corner. It was the most bizarre sequence of play, but it just kind of made me think they're going so overboard now with this playing out from the back as to whether there'll be a correction and whether there'll be a happy medium at some point and we'll see a little bit less playing out from the back, maybe.
I think so. I think it will settle down. I think, obviously, Pep coming over from Spain and introducing a lot more of this, and obviously Klopp's now doing it as well, they've changed their personnel to suit the way that they want to do it. But obviously in the lower divisions, and I've seen championship games, I've seen plenty of championship games because I scout now, and you know, you're thinking, like, I feel sorry for some of the goalkeepers that are put under really bad pressure from, you know, really poor balls, you know, back to them. No real thought. And I think a lot of the time, I think even in my day towards, you know, the end of when the back pass came in, I think a lot of the time it's kind of an easy option for defenders to actually turn around and just put it back to you. You know, if they don't fancy it, if they don't fancy a pass, oh, well, that's the easy ball back to you. Never mind if the centre forward's reading it and that's actually going to be down your throat as well. So I've seen it, League Two, locally, I've been to games where I've just been sitting there shaking my head, really. You know, they're splitting the box. People are pushing in because they know what they're trying to do, and yet they're still trying to force the back pass, you know, to play out. So that'll come. A midfield player will come all the way back with his back to play and expect the ball to be given to him. And then the goalkeeper gives him it. And guess what? He goes straight back to the goalkeeper. And this time he's got to hit it through a not particularly fantastic surface first time, when he could have done that, you know, and been probably more accurate in the first place. So I think certainly League One, League Two really do have to reevaluate as to whether that is, you know, sort of the best practice for them.
I mentioned Bobby Mims there. He's quite a fitting mention because he was at Everton early on in his career, which is exactly where you joined him after leaving Colchester. I'm going to throw a few stats at you before we go on.
Okay.
Four seasons ever present at Colchester. In your first full season, no goalkeeper conceded less goals at home and only three others conceded more all season. This was 1983-84. Two of those teams were York and Bristol City, who got promoted. I think Colchester finished seventh or eighth. You were only 19, turning 20 at the time. Quite impressive for a young keeper in such what I imagine was a physical Division 4.
Yeah, it was. I didn't even know those stats, so thanks very much.
Not a problem.
I had an amazing break there. Mick Walker was the first team goalkeeper, and he'd played for, I think, five or six years without missing a game. So I'd followed a sort of Colchester legend, which is obviously difficult, but at the same time, he passed on. I'd been there for you know, best part of half a season before I got a break when he actually got injured. I played the first this game just after Christmas, and I played three games on the trot there while he recovered, and then I played the very last game of that season. But in that season, I'd gone from Ipswich youth team the year before. I had 1 year in professional football. Then I went to Colchester, where I started to enjoy playing a bit more because I was playing in a reserve team in the Eastern Counties League. So we were playing against men. So that was a great grounding. We had a very young team. It was almost like, we had a lot of good young players that were either in and around the first team. Obviously, we all trained with the first team Monday to Friday, but then played for the reserves on a Saturday afternoon like everybody else. So it was great. You know, it really felt like you were playing proper football. So that was a great grounding. Mick was obviously a massive influence on me, worked closely with me, couldn't have been more helpful. And that was the first real sort of person that took me under his wing and really tried to improve me. So I owe Mick a lot. But when I got my chance, it was, you know, it was one of those. They tried to sort of soften the pressure, if you will, by saying, look, you know, Mick's going to step down and take the reserves now. You're going to start the team. I was given a one-year contract. I think I was on about £75 a week. And, you know, the rest is history, really. I just luckily took to it, and I had a pretty good team in front of me, and that obviously helps as well. We had brought in Stuart Houston, who was obviously an ex-Man United player, coming to the end of his career, but he was sort of player coach. So he was normally played one of the centre halves. So again, you know, learning from some of the experienced players, but we also had some talented youngsters like Parry Groves, Keith Day, and Farrell. You know, we had a few lads that were coming through the system as well. So it was a lovely balance, and you know, I look back so fondly with to those days. And in actual fact, in two Saturdays' time, we've got a reunion back at Colchester United from that era.
Oh, lovely. Some great names there really are. And I mean, from Colchester, you moved to Everton, which at the time was a huge leap to go from Division 4 to Division 1. And not only that, you were joining the then top flight champions.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it was an amazing time. I was getting married that year as well. So we'd had a stag do the night before. So it was obviously at the end of the season. And my best man was Keith Bowen, who's a Northampton lad, and the reason that I live in Northampton now, really. We got on like a house on fire. Anyway, I'd bought a house in Ipswich because it was further away from London, a bit cheaper, to be honest with you. So we'd got a night out in Colchester area, had a coach, and we got dropped back off. So I had a few people staying around my house. The phone rang the next morning. Obviously, there was a few hangovers, to say the least. And Keith Bowen is an Everton fan. So the phone rang, and it was Terry Darricott, who was the assistant manager to Colin Harvey at the time. And it was this, obviously, hi there, lad. Can I speak to Alex Chingley, please? He was so Keith was like, who is it, mate? He said, it's Terry Darricott. He said, I won't say what he said, but he obviously told him to do one, basically, and put the phone down. He thought it was one of the lads.
It was a wind-up.
Yeah, I thought it was a wind-up. So phone rang straight back again. He said, no, seriously, you want to speak to Alex Chingley's Everton Football Club, Terry Darricott, you know. So he shouts me, I'm still in bed. I've come down the stairs, obviously feeling a bit worse for wear, say the least. Spoke to them. And I said, look, you know, trying to sort of clear your head straight away. I said, look, I've just had my stag do last night. I'm really sorry, you know, apologies about my best man here, you know, not believing you. I said, but I'm getting married on Saturday. I said, and I'm going away for 2 weeks honeymoon. He said, no problem. Go away, get married, la, la, la. He said, we'll meet you. As soon as you get back, fly back in. We'll meet you. And it turned out they met me at Luton. There was a hotel just off Junction 11, and we met there. And I think the weekend after, we went up and they showed us round, and that was it, really. That was literally how it was done in those days. No agents, no, It was just purely the club getting in touch with the player. Off you go. The club obviously had agreed a price with Everton, and that was it. There was no messing about. You know, they put me into a club flat for a year in Southport. And as it turned out, we bought a house up in Southport and only lived in it for about 6 weeks, I did personally. Mm. And then I got moved down to Luton. So, you know, that's just how it was, though. But
did you get a rise from your £75 a week?
I did. I think I went up to 400 quid a week.
Oh, wow. What a rise that is.
Huge.
So yeah. It was big. I mean, I went back to Colchester, you know, at some point that in the first 2 or 3 months, I had to go back for something. And I went over to where we used to train on the army fields, where we used to jog round to. And I remember the lads giving it, oh, here he is, big time Charlie. Because I'd changed my car, they were like, oh yeah, giving it all that with your new car and that. You know, the banter was still the same, but it wasn't like, I wasn't driving a flash car, I can assure you. You know what I mean, Rich?
Yeah.
So it was just literally practical, you know, and I just had to get a better car. Because my car, when we went up to Southport for that weekend to have a look round, I had a Toyota something or other. I can't remember what it was. I'm not a car man at all. But it was a sort of bit of a sporty looking one for me. Yeah. But the water, it bounced down with rain. It was coming in through the windscreen. Oh, so we had to borrow some towels from the Everton training ground and put them across the dash to stop the water flooding the car. It was unbelievable. So I did need a new car. That was my excuse. I said, lad, you won't believe what happened when I went up to Everton. You know, it was one of those things. I had to change the car.
Yeah.
So I was hardly a millionaire, let's put it like that. Yeah. You know, 400 quid a week. It was hardly, I was hardly going to be drinking champagne.
No, it's amazing how things have changed, hasn't it? You can imagine someone now making the move from, effectively the move would be from a League Two club to a top six club, you know, to think of how everything's changed so much within a reasonably short period of time. And of course, you go in there was Neville Southall, who arguably at the time was, it must have been one of the best goalkeepers in the world at that time.
Yeah.
I've got so many questions about him, but how was it, to work with him professionally? I'm sure he must have been incredible to work with and given you a lot of advice. And then also as a character, have you got any stories about him?
Yeah, I mean, loads. He was fantastic. He was injured when I first went there. So Bobby was playing, Bobby Mims. And then I was sort of travelling around, Bobby was playing, Nev got fit, and then there was talk. Oh, Mike Stowell was there as well. Who's obviously Stowell? He's been around and still at Leicester now, and he was a really talented goalkeeper. So they had some great goalkeepers and great for me to work with. Nev got himself fit after a couple of months, probably early autumn, September, October time. So they let Stowell went on loan, I think, first. Then Mimsy went out on loan. So I was then literally travelling around with the first team and going everywhere with Nev. But a bit like Mike Walker, but obviously a different stage of his career. But Nev was amazing with me, you know, because he literally took me under his wing, encouraged me so much. I used to run with him on away trips and would just sit there or lay there in bed with the lights off, you know, into the early hours of the night, just talking goalkeeping with him, really. And he, again, a bit like Ben, he had a fantastic attitude towards it. He just had so much confidence in himself. He really did. And why not? You know, because like you say, he was arguably the best goalkeeper in the world at the time. And he, you know, he was an inspiration, really, to train with. I mean, we had Gordon Banks that used to come in once a week in those days to take us training for goalkeeping training. Amazing. And obviously that was an amazing experience. But watching Nev train, and I always say to people, he would hold things that I would be happy to just keep out the net. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could get a hand on it, I'd be buzzing. He was holding them. You know, that was I think it gave you a great kind of experience in terms of the levels that were required to play at the top level. And so, not that I was the character that I thought I'd cracked it sort of thing, you know, I think, you know, Rich knows me well, but, you know, you've got to keep working on the basics, you've got to keep working, and you never, ever are going to be too good not to go back to, handling the ball and doing all the right things. And Nev was very good at everything, really. And for a guy that wasn't a giant, you know, he was not afraid to come and mix it on crossings as well. And obviously the kicking was different nowadays. It was the big volley, wasn't it? A lot of the time, you know, the side volley wasn't even in the game then. So you either half volleyed it or volleyed it. And Nev volleyed it. I was a half volleyer. He was brilliant. And there were times where we'd go to a game. And I remember one at West Ham where I was warming him up. And he'd only had about 5 minutes of handling and whatnot. And he said, all right, you go in goal now. I went, no, Nev, I'm warming you up. He said, no, you go in. He said, I've had enough. I'm all right. I feel good. So he literally put me in goal, and I was thinking, oh, God, he's just going to whack, because he obviously had a fierce old strike on him. Yeah. But he wasn't actually even going to hit the target. He was trying to hit the policemen's helmets off their heads as they were looking at the crowd. So I was just standing there, really, you know, getting the balls and fielding them back to him, and he kept just putting his hat up. If he hit one of the policemen, he just kept apologising as if it was a mistake. It was hilarious.
Did you ever get on the wrong side of him, Chamber? Because I imagine if you cross Neville Southall, it's not going to be a pleasant experience.
No, I didn't. No, I'm not that stupid. I was his sort of gopher, really. I would obviously make all the tea and what in the room. Once again, he was quite an eccentric in his preparation. He say we travelled down to London for a game against West Ham or whatever it was. We'd get to the hotel, and from that moment, we wouldn't see the players until we got back on the coach the next day. He wouldn't eat with the players. He had room service delivered to the room, so obviously I stayed with him. And even pre-match meal had delivered. So it was, I'd never seen that before or since. But, you know, that was the way he did it. And obviously, you know, he had so much standing at the club that it literally let him do what he needed to do to prepare. The other thing that was a bit different was, I mean, I did, with Graham Taylor, we used to do a Saturday morning little training session where we used to have to take our own kit with us on away games, going into like a school field or a park to do a little bit of a loosener and then set pieces and things like this. And then obviously take our own kit home and wash it. That was the other thing. But with Everton, with Nev, he used to always insist that the head tennis nets were put under the coach. And Colin Harvey and Terry Darricott, myself and Nev, we'd go somewhere. The coach would take us to Hyde Park, Regent's Park, wherever it was. They'd set up the court and we'd play head tennis on the morning of a game. again, he just got bored. He just didn't like being in the room all that time without actually going out, getting a bit of fresh air, doing something just to occupy and stimulate him. But he didn't want to interact with the team. It was different, but it worked for him. So, who are we to say it was wrong? It clearly wasn't.
Well, he was obviously the number one that season, which culminated in you going on loan to Tranmere for a short spell. Now, this brings me on to that bit of trivia that I referred to at the start of the podcast. Now, I'm pretty sure I've got this right. So, first time in a matchday squad for Everton was the Charity Shield at Wembley in 1987 against Coventry. You were on the bench.
That's right.
Later that year, you joined Tranmere on loan, who also went to Wembley in that brilliant Mercantile Credit Centenary Trophy, which was the 100-year anniversary of the Football League. And we'll get onto this later, but you also had a very brief flirtation with Liverpool and again enjoyed a trip to Wembley in the 1995 League Cup final. So that's three trips to Wembley, all in the squad, but not the starting 11, all with the three Merseyside clubs.
Well, you're almost right. The Tranmere one, I played all the qualification games for Tranmere, but I'd by the time that finished, I'd done my 3 months, which was the maximum you're allowed to do on loan, so I wasn't allowed to play at Wembley for Tranmere. So I actually went with Everton on the bench again to the Mercantile Credit Tournament and had to sort of watch Tranmere, and that's really with the big emergence of Tranmere, who then went on and did some great things. Unfortunately, they've gone down the ladder a little bit, but they've got themselves back in the Football League now, thankfully. But I wasn't allowed to, because of the rules and regulations. You know, 3 months was the most you could do. Eric Nixon came in from Manchester City on loan and eventually stayed there and had a great, you know, finish off to his career at Tranmere, and they went up the divisions. I had a fantastic 3 months there. You know, again, we had some really good young players, mixture of experience, a great blend of experience and youth. And we went from the bottom of Division 4 onto the edge of the playoffs in that 3 months. So it couldn't have gone better, really. I had a fantastic time.
They were funny old tournaments, weren't they, those? I mean, they were brought in at the time when the Hazel disaster, so there was no European football. But you had the Mercantile Credit, you had the full Members' Cup, even the Soccer Sixes. Did you play in that, by the way, for Luton? Who won that in 90? Were you in that side?
No, I did play in the five sides, but we didn't do great in time. I think only once I can recall, and the pitches were awful. I mean, we obviously played on the plastic pitch at Luton, but there was a bit of give in that one. But these were like literally just almost like a bit of carpet rolled onto solid concrete. And so you got absolutely ripped to pieces when you played in those five-a-side tournaments. Trust me, awful.
Want to touch on your experience with Liverpool. And Liverpool's story is quite an intriguing one. We had Dave Besant on the show recently who, let's say, fell foul of a pot of salad cream, which cost him injury and cost him a time out of the team. For you, it was a bizarre case of an ironing board to one of the Liverpool goalkeepers.
It was.
What happened exactly?
Yeah. Well, as I'm led to believe, I didn't, obviously wasn't there at the time, but I think it was a guy called, it was a Danish guy, I think, called Michael Lingard, was it?
Stensgaard, I think.
Stensgaard, yeah. Right, okay. Yes, and apparently he'd obviously hurt his shoulder. It wasn't a couple of times before, so it was one of those where there was probably a weakness with the muscles and the tendons around the joint. But yeah, he went to get his ironing board out to do a bit of ironing. The ironing board fell out at him. He went to grab it and his shoulder popped out a joint for about the third time. So, really bad luck for him. They then had this Coca-Cola Cup final coming in a couple of weeks and decided that they needed an experienced goalkeeper sitting on the bench. They had Ted Warner, who was a very talented young goalkeeper, but they obviously thought, you know, if anything was to happen to David James on the day, they would want someone that maybe could, you know, handle the occasion a bit better. So I was, at the time, not playing at Sunderland. Tony Norman had got his place back in front of me. And so, you know, it wouldn't happen today because obviously everybody keeps their squads together. But Mick Buxton said, off you go. You can go. And, you know, it was one of those strange situations where I turned up. I trained with Joe Corrigan, who was full-time goalkeeping coach there. Obviously, David James, the first day. First day I was there, it snowed like crazy in the build-up to training. So it's an interesting, you know, what a ball's like with snow on it. Mm. It was a little bit tricky, to say the least. Joe Corrigan absolutely worked our socks off, and I nearly threw up. I remember that as well. Because at Sunderland, we weren't getting any goalkeeping coaching, other than a little bit of work in sort of like a warm-up with Jim Montgomery, who was working with the under-18s. But it was literally a few hands, you know, a little bit of up and down, then off you pop and join in with the team. With Joe, it was, oh dear, it was a beast. You got a beast in.
Yeah.
And that first morning, I'll never forget, yeah, it was my breakfast nearly came back out again.
That's prime Spice Boys era as well. You were with Liverpool. You're 1 year away from the Ecru suits.
I was.
The year
I
after.
Was, yeah. I don't think I'd have looked good in that suit. I've got to be honest, that wasn't my colour.
You could have pulled it off, mate.
Oh, do you reckon?
Yeah.
Thanks, mate. Well, it was certainly a lively dressing room. I mean, I remember Neil Ruddock playing Back for Good, you know, the Take That song.
Oh, yeah.
And they're all mates with Robbie Williams and all the Take That lads. So they'd given, you know, like an early copy of Back for Good, and they used to sing that on the way to games. And so they're all friends of the stars, you know what I mean? It was kind of bizarre, really, you know. And, you know, they had Robbie Fowler, Ian Rush was still playing, Jamie Redknapp in midfield. the list is endless. You know, they were, you know, and it was a great experience. You know, being around that and seeing how they went about things. Roy Evans was the manager, and you know, Liverpool won that cup. McManaman got to beat Bolton. Jason McAteer was playing for Bolton, and he obviously said to me, "Sign for Liverpool next season," and that's when the Spice Boys thing came in.
Well, obviously you got your chance a few years later with Watford to play at Wembley when they won the playoffs against Bolton again, bizarrely. Successive promotions under Graham Taylor, you were the hero in those semi-finals, the penalty shootout, and that's what we want to talk about, that Birmingham game. Firstly, the Kevin Poole penalty, by the way, an absolute thunderbolt against you.
Yeah, I've had a few goalkeepers score past me. Kevin Pressman did it as well. The NFA Cup replay. But Kevin Poole, obviously, he hit it into the roof of the net above me, but he struck it well, fair to say.
It was quite funny because you're both wearing exactly the same kit.
Same kit, yeah. Yeah, Lecoq Sportif, yeah, the bright green. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I've still got that one. I've got that one framed. Obviously, that was a nice one to keep. In as much as, you know, the memories that come flooding back when you think about it. And I've got a great poster from that day where it says May 31st, 1999, a day to remember. And then it's like a collage of pictures from the day. So that's one of my treasured memorabilia things.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember it well personally, actually, because it was the season. The following season was my first season as an apprentice, actually coming to the club full time. So I remember being with my dad watching the semi-final, and yeah, crazy night. And then the final itself, of course, Wembley, Bolton. I want to just touch on Graham Taylor, actually, a bit, because obviously you worked with him for quite a period of time. And
yeah,
prior to the semi-final, am I right in saying that he got you guys to do a lot of penalty practice and he worked quite on that? He was quite forward-thinking, wasn't he, in a lot of his ways?
He was, yeah. Because we were renting our training ground, we had to get out of our training ground at Stanmore at the end of end of the football season. So we actually trained at Old Merchant Taylor's school, and you know, it was quite a lovely, like, really nice, well-kept sports ground that they have there. And so we had the pitch marked out exactly the same size as Wembley.
Wow.
And we did all our training there and the build-up, obviously, because I think from the semi-final at St Andrews to the final, there's probably at least 10, 11 days. So you've got a long, long sort of period, a long build-up. But almost on a daily basis, when we did train, we always finished the session with penalties, and he made the lads take the walk from the halfway line and, do it all with the whistle. So they had as good a preparation as they could. Obviously, you can't replace the stress and the pressure of the moment, but it certainly paid off because, I mean, some of the penalties that our boys took that were just inside or under the underside of the bar and everything like that. I mean, I'm sure they might not have meant to do it quite as tight as that, but there was only one that sadly missed. He just dragged it wide, you know, and everybody else hit brilliant penalties. So Kenny Jackett had given me a tip-off on Paul Furlong's penalty, so I went the way that he said, and that was probably the best of the two saves I made. That was a good strong hand to my right. And then Chris Holland's, I think his nerves just got the better of him. He didn't get a good penalty, and it was one of those. As soon as I went the right way, I knew I was going to keep it out, and we started celebrating and looking forward to Wembley.
Managers, Chambo, now you've worked with some top names over the years. We've spoken about Graham Taylor already. Bobby Robson was boss at Ipswich when you were there, and I read a lovely quote because he was also the manager who let you go when you went to Colchester.
Yes.
And at the time he said, "You're the one I think I'm making a mistake about." That must have been quite nice to hear.
It was absolute gobsmack. I was, obviously, I came late into football at 17, dragged out of sort of county football, been spotted by Ron Gray, the scout there at Ipswich Town. And I'd not had a particularly good year. You know, I played youth team football, broke my wrist as well. But really and truly, I knew in my heart of hearts that I was hadn't done enough to get a pro contract. So Bobby Robson had all the lads that were getting released up in his office at the same time. A little bit impersonal, maybe, but at the same time, he went along the line, and I was literally the last one in the line. He was going along saying, look, you know, unlucky, you know, but, you know, such and such a club want you to go on trial there, blah, blah, blah. I was at the end thinking, there's nobody going to want me, you know, I'm just going back to Ramsey, you know, and go back to Ulla Farm. But he got down to me and he said exactly that. He said, you're the one I think I'm making a mistake about. And inside I'm thinking, no, you're not, Bobby. You're absolutely not making a mistake. I haven't done enough, you know. But to my relief, he said that Alan Hunter's now gone up to Colchester United, who played a lot of games for Ipswich, centre-half, Northern Ireland international. He'd taken the youth team for a few times when Brian Owen had been away on international duty with England. He'd obviously saw something in me that he liked, and that's why I ended up at Colchester from Ipswich. So I just had an amazing lucky break, really, which is obviously something that you need. You need to then obviously take your chance, which, you know, I had so many little sort of things that happened in that chain of events with getting released, going to Colchester, Mick then getting injured for the first time for 5 or 6 years. So all these sort of ducks were in the row, and I managed to sort of forge my career from those lucky breaks.
Do you know what? There's loads more we could talk about in terms of your career, and there's probably a separate podcast for post-career as well. And just want to touch on a few things since you've retired. So obviously you went into coaching, obviously coaching the likes of myself, Scott Loach, Almunia Gomez, Foster, Jonathan Bond, Jack Bonham, and several other goalkeepers as well, involved with the Wales under 21 setup. But you've always been very close to Sean Dyche. And I know, I remember our time, and again, that's a podcast in itself, I think, talking about Sean Dyche.
Got a few stories there.
Just a few stories there, but maybe not for today. But you're doing a bit of work for him at the moment, aren't you, with being a goalkeeping scout, which is something that intrigues me, and obviously a big part of this show where we're trying to give a bit of a goalkeeper's perspective on things. And again, we've had so many guests now, and it's nice that there seems to be a real theme with each goalkeeper, a lot of similarities. But the fact that you've been brought on as a goalkeeping scout is quite unique from what I understand. But do you think it's something that we'll see more of, that ex-goalkeepers will be brought in by clubs in order to recruit the next lot of goalkeepers?
Well, I think it certainly makes sense, doesn't it? You know, if you've got people like myself, like Dave Besson, you mentioned earlier, Tony Parks, obviously, that we saw recently. You know, all these people have got so much experience and an eye for goalkeeping and goalkeepers. Why would you not use that? And, you know, obviously, I've got a great relationship with Sean and Martin Hodge, who sort of heads up the recruitment department. So, at the moment, they're obviously quite well blessed with goalkeepers. So, I am doing more on outfield scouting as well. But obviously you keep your eye on the goalkeepers naturally when you go to games anyway. So it's nice to be, you know, still involved in the game. And the coaching, as you say, with the Welsh under-21s is fantastic. You know, really enjoy that side of things as well. So I've got a nice balance to life at the moment. Mm.
And last question, and we ask everyone this. If you could sum up the life of a goalkeeper in one sentence, how would you sum it up?
Well, the highs outweigh the lows, for sure. I mean, I've thoroughly enjoyed my time, but I think you've got to be resilient. I think you've got to be prepared that when things don't go well, but really enjoy the highs. Enjoy your moments when you've come off that field and nobody can get the ball past you. There's no better feeling. You know, goal scorers obviously they can point to that, but we can point to where we've made save after save, you know, where we're reading the game perfectly, where we're coming and taking crosses, our distribution's great. The whole part of your game is on top form. No better feeling, I don't think.
Brilliant, Jamie. We always say one sentence, but we know that it's never going to be one sentence.
No, sorry. Yeah, I mean, so that was a long-winded sentence, wasn't it? But listen, yeah, it's been great fun, lads. I'm quite happy to talk a load of nonsense again with you some other time if you so wish. You know that.
Very much. Look forward to it. Alex Chamberlain, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much indeed, lads.
Well, that was Alex Chamberlain. Thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed that. I love a bit of 80s and 90s chat on this podcast.
You do. Your information from certainly the 90s in particular is I'd have to say, if there's anybody out there that has more or better information, I'd love to do a quiz, but I think you would win.
But a varied career, right? I mean, an incredible career, as is always seems to be the case with goalkeepers, and some great stories there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I've got nothing but good words to say about Alec. Obviously, those that know me and my career at Watford, he was obviously a huge part of that. And it was quite bizarre because my first memory of Alec was, you remember Saves Galore? In fact, yeah. Of course you remember Saves Galore. But it was then the up-and-coming Alec Chamberlain on those plastic pitches and so on and so forth. And fantastic goalkeeper. Then coming through at Watford, I remember I first met him when I was very young. Used to go from school into the training ground. But the thing I remember was how welcome he made me feel. And at the time, he wasn't first choice at Watford at the time, and then gradually became first choice and just went on and on and on and was so reliable, so consistent in everything he did. And that was him as a character as well. So then when he became coach, it was an interesting period because I then eventually got a position ahead of him, and we kind of yo-yoed a bit, if I remember rightly, but I got a position ahead of him. But the way that he then instantly turned into coach, turned into the mentor, and was so supportive was huge for me when I think back. And, you know, he was obviously the coach when I had a few games in the Premier League and Championship, and pretty much for the entire time that I was at Watford, other than a brief spell under Kevin Hitchcock. So, no, delighted to say that we're still close friends now, and nothing but good things to say about him. And he's helped so many goalkeepers. I touched briefly in the podcast on the likes of Scott Loach and Almunia Gomez. I've got no doubt that all these guys would have spoke so positively. And, of course, Ben Foster. Again, we mentioned his name, but Alec had a huge impact on Ben. And Ben, the words that he spoke about Alec over the years very much echo my thoughts.
Okay, well, from a consistent goalkeeper, as you've described, into someone who's been inconsistent, I guess we can say, this season, Sergio Rico at Fulham. This weekend, the opening goal, Paul Pogba, who Sergio Rico anticipated would cross, but struck inside the near post. All the commentary was about the fact that he'd been beaten on the near post. What's your take on the goal?
I mean, we'll talk a lot, and no doubt we'll talk a lot in future podcasts, about goalkeeping intelligence. And there are times when you will anticipate. For instance, if you think there might be a through ball, you'll be on the front foot. You might nick a yard if you can to try and read certain situations. But there are certain situations when you cannot try to read what's going to happen. A good example would be a free kick. How many times do we see it where a goalkeeper will try and nick a yard behind the wall to maybe make a save and then get beaten on their side, which is an error? And that's very similar to what happened to Rico yesterday. He's tried to anticipate the ball going across the goal, and just by putting the weight, moving his weight to his left-hand side, he instantly had no chance of getting back to the right and making a save. So it does go down as a goalkeeping error. Ideally, in that situation, the position he had was fine. It was okay. You know, he wasn't overly covering the near. That can be a mistake that goalkeepers fall into, where they almost hug the near post. He wasn't doing that. His position was okay. But you have to stay balanced until the shot happens, and then you react to the shot. You cannot go before the shot is taken. And unfortunately for Fulham, it ended up being quite costly because they were doing quite well up to that point. But how often do we say it, that goals change games? And unfortunately for him, it was an error of his that was quite costly.
It's funny because I watched that and had your voice ringing in my ears as I was trying to analyse the situation. And I thought he moved too early because of the cross. And it's one of those where, had the cross come in, he would have been in a good position to collect it. So on one hand, he was showing initiative. But on the other hand, should he have thought, hang on, this is Paul Pogba, and recognised who he was coming up against and thought, he's probably going to try and shoot?
I don't think even that matters. It doesn't matter who's having the shot. The same rules apply, you know, because it could be, you could then argue it could be someone that was nowhere near the level of Paul Pogba, and actually they just shank it and it goes in the corner. You know, it makes no difference. So I'm going to go back to the idea and the cliche that often comes out, oh, he's been beaten at his near post, therefore it's an error. That's not true. You get beaten at your near post sometimes, and it's not always an error. In this case, it was an error because of the anticipation. I think you've just got to be aware as to when you can anticipate and when you don't. There's an argument to be said if it's a one-on-one, for instance, that you see their body shape shaping up that they're going to go across you, that you start to go early. Of course, you'd anticipate if it's a penalty more often than not, unless you know they're the type of player that's going to wait until the last second and watch your movement, in which case you don't anticipate. So it's everything. There's a rule of thumb for everything, but certainly shots on the angle, you can't guess. You can't start to read it. Otherwise, players will see that. For all we know, Pogba might have watched footage of Rico and seen that he's done it before, and that's why he's gone there. So you need to be so careful as to what decisions you make, as to when you anticipate, but certainly shots on the angle you cannot anticipate.
You mentioned penalties there. There was an incident on Sunday between Spurs and Leicester where Leicester had the penalty. James Maddison was readying himself to take it. Jamie Vardy came on, took the penalty, and it was saved by Hugo Lloris. My question on this one is, has the change in penalty taker helped Hugo Lloris in the fact that he may have studied Jamie Vardy in the past, whereas James Maddison hasn't taken as many penalties this season? Or I would just love to know his mindset when that change has happened, because he's prepared himself for Maddison and then Vardy's came on at the last second to then take the ball and take it himself.
I think there's more of an argument from Leicester's point of view that Vardy coming on and his first touch of the ball is to take a penalty, that it can be quite difficult. You know, you talk about subs coming on and have to getting into the game, getting up to the pace of the game, to having to come on and do a set piece, a penalty, and try and place it where you ordinarily would. You know, you wouldn't do that in training, for instance. You wouldn't suddenly go to training and the first thing you do in training is hit a penalty and have to hit the top corner. You know, normally you would warm up in training to do that. So I don't think it necessarily would have made too much of an impact on Lloris, other than he would have known, if Madison's taken it, I'm doing X. If Vardy's taken it, I'm doing Y. So the moment that Vardy then takes the ball, he would have changed his mind to what he was going to do, and he would have known in his mind what Vardy is likely to do, which obviously in the end worked out to be very positive. But no, I think it's more the fact I was surprised that Vardy took it, if I'm honest. I just think coming on, first touch of the game, it just seems quite a bit of pressure when you're not in the flow of the game to then come and have such an important moment.
Okay, that's it for another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us, please do so at GK Union on Twitter, at GK Union Official on Instagram, search GK Union on Facebook, or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. It's the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon.